Hi, I'm Mark Reisner, president of the American Stamp Dealers Association, and you are listening to Stamp Show Here Today.
Return to sender. Stamp collecting happens when we dream together.
Welcome to Stamp Show Here Today, episode number 82.
I'm Cash.
This is Tom.
I'm Scott.
And I'm your host, Dawn. This week we'll be answering listener email, early advertising with stamps, Cash's corrections, and our expert topic is on expertizing and grading of patent medicine stamps. So we get emails.
Again?
Yes.
Yay!
Summon the answer squad. From Patrick Reedy.
Hi, Patrick.
Hey, Patrick. Our question is there any danger you can think of using C-mounts to mount my stamps if I use a hinge to attach the C-mount? Thanks as always.
So everybody, a C-mount is a Scott's mount. They have V-mounts and C-mounts. V-mounts make a V when you open them. C-mounts make a C when you open them. They're split in the middle.
We also call those split-back mounts.
Right, split-back mounts. And those are the ones that most of the time when you see mint stamps, they'll have a line across the back, which destroys their never-hinged status.
It's because even though those mounts are technically gummed on the back and you can just wet them and put them on the paper, a lot of times when you're mounting those stamps, you want to get that stamp in the mount and you don't wait for that to completely dry. And then obviously you put your stamp in there and the moisture gets around the edge of the stamp and seeps through that split line there, causing the stamp gum to be disturbed. Therefore, technically it's hinged, not never hinged.
Yep, you'll lose a big premium, big hunk of money there. So he's asking, what if you use one of those, but instead of licking the back of the mount, you put a hinge on it instead?
Well, I did that in my first album, and that worked pretty well. And I had a lot less problems with moisture seepage because obviously there was a lot less moisture there. There really isn't that much, other than just getting sloppy, there isn't really any difference whether you use a hinge or not.
Well, my advice to them would have been put the mounts on the page without the stamps in them.
Absolutely.
Mount up the page, then wait, and then come back later and put the stamps in the mounts.
Right. You want the page to dry. And another thing with those C-mounts is generally when you dampen the back, you dampen a larger area than you would with a hinge. And that can kind of cause a little rippling of the paper because such a large area is moistened. So if you want to prevent that, then you kind of have to press your pages after you put the mounts on as well.
Yeah.
As they're drying, just like you would after soaking a stamp. And that way, the wavy warping of the album page won't occur. But you want to make sure everything is completely dry before putting your stamps in.
Yeah.
And that, to me, I mean, if you're doing that, I would go through and do a section in my album, maybe, and then set it aside, and then maybe the next day come back and put the stamps in the mounts.
I think I actually kind of like his idea, though, because I've come across pages like that where the C-mount is mounted directly to the page, and it can be a real pain in the butt to try and get a stamp in and out of there like that.
Oh, yeah.
So if you have the whole mount on a hinge that you can be able to flip that whole mount over, I think that's not necessarily a bad thing.
Well, also on top of that, when you open up the C-mount, every time you exercise that plastic area where it's sealed at the top and at the bottom, you put stress on it. So any time that you can reduce the amount of stress on that sealed edge is a good thing. It means your mount will last longer.
I can see where it would be important if you move your stamps around. Because then you just slice off the hinge and you take the same mount, same stamp, stick it into the next album.
Yes. Although I would recommend taking the stamp out of the mount.
Yeah.
Because you don't want a chance getting any moisture on the stamp. So, Patrick, thank you for the question.
Alan Bush writes that he liked the Book of Secrets and looks forward to Volume 3. Thank you, Alan. And yes, a Volume 3 is in the works.
Yes, for people who are interested, that's Book of Secrets at gradingmatters.com, or you can buy it on Amazon, or you can buy a Kindle version and other things.
Where can you get that again, Cash?
You can get the Book of Secrets at gradingmatters.com or on Amazon, and there's also a Kindle version available.
And last, an email blast from Wade Soddy for New York 2016 was received. This is probably the last we will speak of New York show, but he did mention the following. Did the show make money? The simple answer at this time is that it looks like we will make a modest surplus when all is said and done. Just how much is yet to be determined, as we still await invoices from the Javits Center, Freeman, our decorators, and several other major suppliers. Really, final bills can take several months to receive and confirm or dispute their charges, as our colleagues running Washington 2006 well know. Nothing different here, but initial estimates definitely have us in the black. Congratulations to Wade and the 2016 crew. It's time for hashtag Stamp Stories, the history of 1880s advertising and patent medicine stamps. Tom?
From the Hagley Museum and Library, the Patricia D. Klingenstein Library of New York Historical Society has a number of almanacs that were printed as advertisements by patent medicine companies. Most people in the 19th century bought an almanac every year and considered them trustworthy sources of information. Unscrupulous patent medicine manufacturers capitalized on that trust by folding their false claims into the familiar format of the almanac, leading people to associate their advertised products with something familiar and dependable. Patent medicines, non-prescription concoctions that were neither legally patented nor clinically proven to cure disease, first appeared in the 1600s, but reached their height of popularity in the 19th century America. The extraordinary demands of the Civil War upon the Federal Treasury resulted in Congress passing the Revenue Act of 1862. The government provided revenue stamps to be affixed to bottles and boxes of various commodities, including patent medicines. Manufacturers were allowed to produce their own stamps as advertising for their product, and this is one of the earliest forms of stamp advertising in the world. So, what are your favorite patent medicine advertising stamps?
Well, first of all, the manufacturers themselves did not produce the stamps. They submitted designs to the government, and the government printed the stamps for them.
Absolutely correct. Absolutely correct. Yeah, they were private dye
medicine stamps.
Otherwise, a person could just run off a bunch of stamps and steal from the government, which is obviously what they wanted to prevent.
Right. So you would hire an engraver to do artwork, or you would pay a bureau engraver to do the artwork, create the dye. You would pay for the dye.
Yeah.
You would give the dye to the bureau engraving and printing. They would create the plates and print your stamps for you. At, I'm sure, a cost to you, but that was your advertising.
Yeah.
And you had pretty much free license to put whatever you wanted on the stamp.
Oh, yeah. You look at some of these stamps and it's pretty damn clear.
But it was to show that you had paid, your product had paid the tax.
Yeah. And just to go back to define patent medicine was supposed to be patented. But it really wasn't. To get a patent, you had to disclose your ingredients and you had to show that it was useful. And the patent medicine companies obviously didn't want to disclose their ingredients because most of them were like alcohol and pepper. And they had to show that they were useful. And again, a lot of these things were not at all useful. So patent medicine is really sort of a oxymoron almost in this period.
And it wasn't medicine.
Well, that's the story about the snake oil. Snake oil, when they first started, you know, they said, this is oil from snakes, and it's very, very good for you and stuff like that. And it turned out that it really wasn't real snake oil. They put something else in it and called it snake oil. You know, in the 1880s, when people called stuff snake oil, they were kind of using it incorrectly because snake oil was sort of a good thing when it started. It's just that it didn't have any real snake oil in it.
Because I've never met an oily snake.
Opium, morphine, and usually just like high, high, high concentrations of wood grain alcohol were the main components of this stuff.
Fish oil, castor oil, a lot of different ingredients, yes.
Well, yeah, but fish oil and castor oil actually have a use.
Yeah, but they were still included as patent medicines.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think one of my favorite patent medicines would be essence of Jamaica ginger.
Uh-huh.
And basically, there were probably over 100 different brands of essence of Jamaica ginger available, and they were generally in the 160 to 180 proof range. But then they would have ginger root, ground up ginger root, as the basis, and they were marketed for everything from headaches and stomach cramps to missed menstrual periods and whatever. But the high alcohol content is really what medicated you.
Yeah, yeah.
And a lot of times it was prescribed to be taken before bed and then when you wake up in the morning.
Well, now you can put patent medicine stamps on bottles of Everclear.
But what they basically did.
Jamaica ginger came around in the 1820s, I guess, and was available for well over 100 years.
Jamaica ginger. Now I got to remember that one.
As you go into the 20th century, obviously you run into things like prohibition, which was the prohibition of beverage alcohol. Well, this isn't a beverage, it's medicine. So those who couldn't get the beverage would a lot of times drink this.
Mm.
So what the government did is they passed laws that required higher ginger content to make it taste terrible. Because what the government would do is they would boil off all the alcohol and weigh it to make sure that it had enough ginger. Well, if it had other things in there, sometimes they'd use molasses, but this guy used a synthetic chemical, which turned out to be a plasticizer. And the way they found it is it caused paralysis.
Oh.
And they didn't know about it. And you wouldn't have to take very much of it to cause paralysis, but it would cause your legs to be paralyzed. You couldn't lift, your ankles wouldn't work right first. And so you'd have this funny walk. So, and Jamaica ginger was actually slangly called Jake. And so if you had the Jake walk or you had Jake leg, that's what this came from. Oh. It came from drinking Jamaica ginger that was adulterated with this plasticizer.
So what stamp did this have with it?
The one that I pulled up was F. Brown's Essence of Jamaica Ginger. It's actually one of the larger patent medicine stamps, so they're hard to find in sound condition, but it's got a lot of really cool engraving and lots of detail.
A picture of George Washington to give it that air of authority. It's a very professional-looking stamp. When you saw this stamp on this bottle of booze in plastic.
Oh, yeah. The stamp's probably about 3 inches by an inch and 3/4.
And it was a way to advertise this and say, hey, this is a good thing. Look, the U.S. government supports it, and it's got George Washington on it.
Absolutely. And anything with George Washington would be trustworthy.
Oh, people. Mm-hmm. I don't think people today understand how much George Washington was revered. I mean, how much of a superstar he was, and that anything he was attached to was really a big thing.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. But anyway, it's an interesting story about Jamaica ginger and... You've got blues songs, a couple of country songs. You can actually find them. They're written, you know, the Jake Walk blues and things like that. And you can find probably over 100 different bottles from different manufacturers.
I don't know nearly as much about the whole aspect behind it, but I kind of like the Hunt's Remedy stamp because...
Oh, that's one of the best.
It's got a picture of a guy who looks like he's about to beat a skeleton over the head with the bottle.
Yeah, he's beating death off with a bottle of Hunt's Remedy. You're picking
either that
favorite.
Or he's hitting him with Hunt's Remedy, telling you it's going to kill you if you drink it. I'm not sure which. But it's just kind of a macabre stamp.
Mm-hmm. It's also one of the most popular private medicine stamps. And Hunt's Remedy.
See, wait. CSAC. We did do Zombies on Stamps.
Oh, there you go. Zombies on Stamps.
Already done. See, there's a zombie skeleton attacking a guy.
So it's a 3-cent revenue stamp. But I don't know what the contents were, but there's a little ad here. It says it cures headaches, bilious troubles, indigestion, dyspepsia, malaria, conceiviness. I don't even know what that is. Dizziness and all liver disorders. And it's called Little Gems. And
all liver disorders.
All liver, every single one of them. Yeah. No broad claims there, is there?
It looks like costiveness. Is that for people who cures people who spend too much money?
The other one that I like is Oliver Crook and Company's Vegetable Syphilitic Remedy. And it's Dr. Crook's Wine of Tar. And
if you're making wine out of tar, you are a crook.
Uh-huh. Yeah,
it's advertised well.
Yeah, it is advertised well, yes.
Yeah, definitely. But it's likely to kill you, so he doesn't have any legal repercussions because nobody's going to come and sue him.
Yeah, there you go. Do you have any you like?
Well, let's go with this one for the World's Hair Restorer.
Ooh.
Mrs. S.A. Allen's World Hair Restorer and Xylo Balsamum or World's Hair Dress. Unequal for restoring, invigorating, beautifying, and dressing the hair, quickly cleansing the scalp, arresting the fall, and imparting a healthy and natural color to the hair. They never fail to restore gray hair to its original youthful color. No lady's toilet is complete without the Xylo Balsamum or hair dressing. It imparts to the hair a most delightful fragrance and is suited to both young and old. It's shampoo.
Yeah, but it's Xylo Balsamum
with a little color restorer in.
Yeah, they put some shoe black in it.
Yeah, exactly. Like, oh, and Mrs. Winslow's soothing syrup. Oh, here's a good one. Mm. Mrs. Winslow's soothing syrup was indeed a godsend to mothers dealing with fussy teething infants. And there can be little doubt that since this infamous patent medicine, which was first marketed in 1849, contained a whopping 65 milligrams of morphine per fluid ounce, even the most colicky of babies were soothed by a healthy dose.
Yeah, that was followed by the Jamaica ginger.
That soothes your baby because it kills them.
Knocks it out, yeah. The problem was, of course, that this potent concoction often did too good a job when it came to quieting fussy babies. As the American Medical Times put it in 1860, many mothers were sadly, quote, relieved of all further care of their infants, unquote, thanks to this deceptively potent elixir.
Holy crap, I was right.
The American Medical Association listed the syrup as a baby killer in a 1911 publication, effectively dealing a death blow to the medicine as a commercial proposition in the USA, yet its sale continued in the UK up until 1930.
So, Cash, what's your favorite?
Oh, well, my favorite is Dr. Jane and Sons. And actually, they had a neat little thing here that deals directly with the stamps. This was printed. They put out an almanac. These guys were the largest drug company in the country, I think in the world, but definitely in the U.S. And it was talking about counterfeits. And it says, to detect counterfeits, each bottle and box of Dr. Jane and Sons family medicines, if genuine, bears one of the special proprietary stamps, which are each 3 inches long by 7/8 of an inch wide and of varying denominations to suit the different articles. This stamp is invariably so affixed over the cork of each bottle or lid of every box as to render certain its destruction before the contents can be got at. To afford still further protection, the paper used for the outside wrappers, blah, 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 blah. But basically what they're doing is they are using the proprietary stamp, the private dye proprietary stamp, as a means to show people that this isn't a revenue stamp. This is a stamp that protects them from fake medicine. And these guys, like I said, were one of the largest companies in the United States. So this is direct advertising, using their stamps to show that they're bogus medicine. Well, I shouldn't say bogus, that their medicine is something that is something that you can trust and something that people will want to counterfeit because it is so good.
And inadvertently created the first tamper-proof seal. Nobody dumped all our good medicine out and gave you crap.
Well, it is kind of curious. Dr. Jane and Sons wrote that out, but you have to wonder how many other companies said or did the exact same thing, that we have these actual stamps from the federal government. You can trust our concoction because they have these stamps on them. One thing we didn't mention is people don't kind of understand that patent medicine started before the Civil War at about $3.5 million a year back then. In the 1880s, it was at $75 million a year. So they increased, what is that, 20,000% increase. So these guys were advertising a lot and pushing their medicines, and they were incredibly successful.
And now, Cash's corrections. Cash?
Okay, so, well, the big news today is that the Brexit happened today. Breaking news, the Dow was down a whole 3.2%.
Ooh, ooh, ooh!
And it historically, it has not gone down that much since May. So this is a big, big, big thing over the last 2 months, month and a half.
Something like that.
Something like that. Anyway, I can see this very, very easily becoming a major disaster like Y2K.
Well, the London Stock Exchange was only down about the same.
Yeah. Oh, and by the way, Stanley Gibbons stock took a hit. It went from 14 pence to 12 pence. So people who want to buy a lot of cheap stamps, I'm going to bring this up from time to time. Second thing is Nevis. You got to do something about spoiler alerts because you put out a stamp souvenir sheet for Downton Abbey. And it shows Tom and Sybil. And you look at the stamp and you know that Tom and Sybil are going to live happily ever after. You have to put something out there as a warning, you know. No, there might be something that goes on, but you look at the stamps and you go, you know these guys are going to be here forever. Third thing, this is interesting because the Canadian Star Trek stamps that we've talked a lot about. It's got Kirk and Spock and Bones and McCoy.
And Commander Core.
And it has Commander Core. So my question always was, why is Commander Core here? Who cares? And why him? And he's you know, he was only in like one episode and stuff. Turns out the actor who played Commander Core was born in Canada.
So Klingons are Canadian.
Yes.
And lastly, on July 31st, the Henry James 3-ounce rate stamp came out, and I wanted to find out why this person was honored on stamps. And so I pulled 5 fascinating facts about Henry James, and they were all boring, except for one fact where he had a friend who was a lady. She jumped out of a window in Venice in 1894, and it fell onto Henry James to sort through her belongings and finally dispose of her clothing. Unable to sell or burn her dresses, he eventually got into a gondola, rowed to the deepest part of the Venetian lagoon. Here he laid the dresses into the water and tried to make them sink, but the dresses refused to drown. That is why he deserves a stamp. Hashtag stamp worthy. And that's it. Yep. 3-ounce rate. And it fits because 3 ounces is heavy. He needed extra weight to drown the dresses. It fits.
3 ounces is heavy compared to what?
2 ounces.
Thank you.
Oh my God, who the hell cares?
And now our expert topic. Expertizing and grading patent medicine stamps as well as other private dyed proprietary stamps. So Scott, we discuss patent medicine stamps a lot. What other private dye stamps are there?
Well, there's a number of other ones. Thanks for blindsiding me.
Blame him. He wrote the script.
My favorite is probably the fermented fruit juice section or fermented juice section because there's only one. It starts with the RP abbreviation in the Scott catalog. And
beer stamps.
Hold that high. Let's start again. Because those aren't patent dye medicine stamps.
She said, what other private dye stamps?
Yes, I did say that.
Oh. What other private dye? Yeah, private dye. They're not private dyes.
Yes, they were. There was one.
Oh, there was? Oh.
You're thinking of the fermented fruit juice.
Yeah, I was.
Which is different. This is actually a private dye fermented fruit.
Oh.
not fermented fruit juice.
Interesting, interesting.
And there's one stamp listed that's RP1.
Fermented fruit juice.
No fermented fruit.
Fermented fruit.
Doesn't that mean rotten fruit?
Yeah.
Well, that's drunk raisins.
But you also have the RO designation, which is matches.
Mm-hmm.
You have the RS, which is medicines.
Playing cards.
RT. I think RT is playing cards.
You have playing cards. You have perfumes.
Yep.
Which is...
which perfumes are basically an offshoot of medicine also.
Right.
Because most perfumes back then were considered medical.
Are there toiletries?
Yeah, toiletries and stuff like that.
So basically medicine, snake oil, matches, perfumes, and playing cards. So basically private dye for anything found in a Western saloon.
Yeah. Pretty much.
Well, if you look at, you know, the private dyes, what a lot of them turned into were soap and... cosmetics companies.
After you cleaned up at the Western Saloon.
And that's why drugstores took over the corner saloon spots.
Oh, yes.
Fun fact. So anyway, there are quite a few of the private dye stamps, but I think we want to talk about expertizing. We don't normally talk about expertizing and grading, but it's very important to read the headings to this section of the catalog. Because in this section of the catalog, it specifically says that these stamps are valued with small faults. The proper usage of these stamps was, as Cash described earlier, to be placed over the opening of the product, either a bottle top or the lid of a box or something like that, so that you would have to break the seal or tear the stamp or crease the stamp if it was folded over the lid of a box. Obviously, you could open the bottom, but the stamp should still have a crease showing where it went over the edge of the item. So in that respect, those small faults are part of its proof that it's genuine, that it was genuinely used. Now, obviously, you find remainders and things like that. They have no gum. They're considered used, but you can find them without faults. Those are actually worth more than what's in the catalog. The catalog listings are specifically for stamps with small faults. That could be small tears, small creases, tiny thin spots. When they become more than just minor, when they affect how the stamp looks from the front, then those start to be really affecting the value as well. As far as expertizing, they really haven't been faked a whole lot. Just mostly misidentified.
That's what I was going to bring up with the playing card stamps. My specialty is really playing cards. And
one of your specialties.
One of my specialties. And there are three designs that look identical to each other, really. And if you don't read the actual name of the company on the stamps, you'll misidentify them. And that's what I see most.
Now, fakery, other than maybe trimming off perforations or adding perforations, can occur, but it's uncommon. One of the major misidentification points is in the paper. There were generally four different types of papers used, especially on these medicine stamps, match and medicine stamps. You have old paper, which is just basically stamp paper. You have silk paper, which has a high content of red and blue and black fibers, which are generally readily apparent. You have pink paper, which is just what it sounds like. It's basically stamp paper that has a pinkish tinge to it. Sometimes it's more pink than others. And then you have watermarked, which is basically just stamp paper with a double line watermark. So you have four basic types of paper. You also have the experimental silk paper, which can be very rarely found, but those are very tiny, tiny bits of silk thread embedded in the paper, kind of like the first issue revenues. They are different, much, much different than the standard silk paper, which is generally really obvious because there's many, many fibers and they're longer, sometimes 3 or 4 millimeters in length. Very, very obvious. The experimental silk paper, you have just little tiny bits here and there. You might have as few as one or two in an entire stamp, depending on the size of the stamp. So those can be difficult to find and difficult to identify, but they're well worth looking for. But as I said, a lot of times it's in the pink paper, and the pink paper versus not being pink paper is the probably the most difficult area for identification.
Again, these were like afterthought stamps. They didn't go through the quality control that a normal stamp did. And so you'll have some color varieties. Those can be kind of tough because it's hard to get references for them. What's some other things? A lot of neat double transfers here and there.
Yeah, there's as we've said, they're not really common. They're very popular with the people who do collect them. When I see small collections of them in an auction lot, I have never seen them under-described. They generally go for either a very healthy portion of the estimate or overestimate.
Oh, yeah.
They're something that, because you want to get sound stamps or as close to sound as you can, and so many of them have the small faults that you just have to, they're literally very, very few are fault free. And if you're going to insist on fault free, then
you're going to pay through the
You're going to pay.
You're going to search pay. For a long time.
And
too.
As a matter of fact, some of these stamps, if you want small, if you want fault free, you might pay 10 or 20 times what the catalog value shows, even for a fine or a fine, very fine example. Don't even expect to find a superb example, because in many, many cases, they won't exist. As you said, quality control wasn't there. They printed them, they perforated them, and as long as the purveyor of the medicine accepted them, there was no quality control.
Oh, yeah. The engraving was fantastic, and some of the stamps have truly people with epic beards. This is the epic beard period. You know, every other stamp. If it's not George Washington, it's some guy with a huge jumbo beard.
Well, Grizzly Adams beard.
Yeah. some of the things we have seen are people submitting stamps with incredibly small faults that are well-centered. And they might get a good grade with some very, very minor faults or faults that aren't mentioned because they are so trivial. And they'll go for easily four or five times catalog easily and sell very quickly. So condition on these is everything. When, you know, I was speaking with one person, it's like having a stamp that's canceled. You know, if you want a stamp with a very, very light cancel, they're hard to find. Well, these stamps don't have cancels. What you want is very, very light faults. And it's tough. And anybody who's who collects these knows what I'm speaking about. And people who don't, if you come across some of these and they're very nice and you look them up in the catalog and it catalogs 75 cents, be aware that your stamp may be, you know, a $10 stamp instead of a 75 cent stamp if it's in good condition.
Absolutely.
Okay, now you guys have been talking about, you know, the medicine, playing cards and stuff. What about, like, is alcohol fall into this category? Is it a different topic?
Those are
fermented fruit did.
those are different. That's a different category. Mm-hmm. Beer stamps, wine stamps, fermented fruit juice stamps. Those were for beverages.
Uh huh.
These are not beverages.
However, there are. I like wine stamps, and there are when those are used, and they have the nice cancel from the wine company. There are a lot of people who collect those. You know, they're looking for Ernest and Julio Gallo cancels and stuff like that. Very impressive stamps sometimes. And again, those used.
But were those private dye?
No.
No, those weren't.
Not.
Okay. Those, A, weren't private dye, and B, they were for beverages.
And C, the quality thing applies there also because they were punch canceled. They were glued and stapled to barrels.
Or crates
or things like that. I mean, it's exactly the same thing. These things were plastered on uneven surfaces and then destroyed when they were canceled or moved. So a lot of the revenue stamps go through that sort of destruction phase as opposed to just getting a cancel.
Yeah.
Thank you for joining us for episode 82. This has been Cash, Scott, Tom, and I'm your host, Dawn. You can reach us with your questions or comments at stampshowheretoday@gmail.com, Twitter at stampshowht, or leave a message on our Google Voice number 1-949-873-4298. You can also check out our website at stampshowheretoday.com or follow us on Facebook or watch us on YouTube. And as always, keep collecting.
This episode of Stamp Show Here Today is brought to you by the Philatelic Book of Secrets, the book that teaches you about repurfs, regums, color varieties, and much more. Get yours for $10 at www.philatelicsecrets.com today.
Hi, this is Bob Prager with Gary Poser Incorporated, and we're in Long Island, New York, and New Jersey, and our philosophy of Gary Poser Incorporated is this. We would rather pay very fair prices on 9 out of 10 collections that we look at versus trying to just offer very low prices on 1 out of 2 and making a big score. That's never our philosophy. So if you want to be treated fairly, please give us a call anytime at 800-323-4279. And again, my name is Bob Prager. Address unknown. No such person.